Torah ideas. As Rabbi Torchiter actually mentioned last night, I certainly am sure as many of you are zoomed out. So, although it's certainly a bit less of a physical strain to tune into a shiur from your house than to have to go out and go to a shul or something like that, but to even sign up to go onto another Zoom is its own form of mesirut nefesh and sacrifice, I would argue. And so thank you all for joining us. So as people come in, thank you again for coming. Just to note, my name is Rabbi Sammy Bergman. I'm Miskan Rosh Beit Midrash of Beit Midrash Zichron Dov. We are very happy to this week hold a Shavuaton of inspiration and thought on the Jewish community in COVID-19. I would like to, first of all, thank the Bayit for agreeing to at least virtually host this Shavuaton, as well as I would like to thank Miller Wells LLP for agreeing to, I think I got that, I might have gotten that name wrong, one second please, I'm sorry about that, Miller Bernstein LLP, who graciously agreed to sponsor the Shavuaton, so thank you very much for that. Okay, so our topic today, I'm going to admit from the outset, is a big topic. It is a very tricky topic, and I'm not going to pretend that I have all the answers to it, but at least we'll raise some questions and think about the issues together. And maybe I'd love to hear some of the audience's thoughts on this. So as in the advent of COVID-19, over the last few months, we've all been faced with various questions and issues and problems we've all had to deal with on an individual basis and on a communal basis. And I think we've all also seen that in reaction to some of those issues, there have been pronouncements, you know, pronouncements from rabbis or shuls, pronouncements from, say, in Toronto, the Vada Rabbanim of Toronto, from COR, from the OU, from the RCA. Really, it has been a time where we've heard a lot from communal rabbis. Now, if everybody had said the same thing for every issue, this wouldn't be so difficult. It would simply be, we'll follow all of the rabbis' opinions. But as I'm sure many of you know, and for those of you who were here yesterday, as Rabbi Karavkin noted during the panel, not all rabbinic voices sing the same tune. And we've heard, although I would argue that many of the same sensitivities have been shared, but there have been very different opinions coming from the different rabbinic organizations and shul rabbis. Even here in Toronto, there have been different opinions which have been expressed in terms of when to open shul again, how to open shul again, to have minyan outside, not to have minyan outside, what message do we send to the community. This creates a bit of confusion. You know, it creates a certain, I would say, peer pressure also, because if you are a shul and you think one thing, and you're the rabbi of a shul and you think one approach is best for your community, and then every other shul in the immediate vicinity does something a bit different, it's a little bit difficult to know how to react. And it's really a very challenging issue. It certainly speaks to the challenge of, on the one hand, giving every rabbi and rabbinic authority the right to decide what they think is best and to use the knowledge that they have to make decisions for their community, and puts that against the notion of trying to maintain a certain unity among all the rabbis in the community. So the topic then is called for tonight is communal policy in a city with many Mari D'Asra, and I'd like to spend a few minutes exploring some of the issues that arise with when we are encountered with various forms of rabbinic authority. So I'm going to share my short sheet with you now. Hold on just 1 minute. Here we go. And I guess if anyone doesn't see the source sheet, you'll let me know. Just 1 second, please. Looking, don't really see what I want, so we'll just go with this one. Okay. All right, I hope everyone sees where we are. So to begin this discussion, what we really need to begin with is a different sort of question, and it's a very fundamental one, which is as follows. We all, we subscribe to the idea that as Jews, we are all required to the best of our ability to follow Torah law. We know that if the Torah tells us to do something, that we have to follow that to the best of our ability. However, we also have various pronouncements and laws and edicts which don't directly, at least, come from the written Torah. And the question then becomes, what is the source for rabbinic authority generally? Why is it that we generally need to listen to the rabbi of a shul or a rabbinic organization, or even to argue, even to the rabbis who are found in the Gemara and the Mishnah and the sources of rabbinic literature? What gives them authority to dictate to us what to do, both in terms of actual halachic questions, in terms of Jewish law, but also we could ask this in terms of communal issues. If a rabbi says something in terms of the way a community should act that's not explicitly in Jewish law, what makes that binding? Is that binding? So to answer this question, we need to go back to the Torah itself. And the truth is that the Torah itself invests the rabbinic, or some rabbinic authorities, with the ability to both legislate law, according to many opinions, and also to decide on Torah law. If you look here in source number one, and someone please, if you don't, for some reason, see the source sheet, you can let me know. It says in Devarim, chapter 17, Pasuk 8. Ki pale mincha davar la mishpat ben dam la dam ben din la din ben negal la negal. If a case is too baffling for you to decide, be it a controversy over homicide, civil law, or assault, divrei rivot bisharecha, matters of dispute in your courts. So, Torah is describing a case here in which there is a question, or even a dispute between parties, and they don't know how to resolve that dispute, or how to answer that question. And the Torah says, v'kamta ve'alita al makom asher echar Hashem lokech bo. You should get up and ascend toward the place that Hashem, your God, will choose. Uvatal akonim v'halviyim v'hashofet asher yeh b'yamim lahim. And you shall go to the priests, Miriam, to the priests and the Levim and the judge that are there in those days. B'derashah v'higidu lecha etivar mishpat. So the Torah is telling us here that there is a mechanism to answer our questions and to solve our disputes. The Torah says there are rabbinic authorities, there are Levim, there are Kohanim, and Shoftim, and if we have a question, we are told to ask that question to them. V'asita apiha davar asher yagidu lecha, min ha-makom ahu asher echar Hashem, v'shamarta laso kechol asher yarucha. And you should do according to, or you should listen to, adhere to the words that they tell you from that place that Hashem will choose. And you shall be careful to observe everything that they instruct you. Al piya Torah asher yarucha v'al mishpat asher yomru lecha ta'aseh, lo tasor me'adavar asher yagid lecha yamin u'smal. Based on the law which they instruct you, and the law which they tell you to do, that's what you should do. You should not deviate from the thing that they tell you, either to the right or to the left, which many commentators suggest means whether they are being more lenient than you would have been, or they are being more strict than you would have been, you should follow the advice of the rabbinic leaders. The ish asher yaseh bezadon levatishmo ha-kohen ha-meid l'sharet sham d'ashem lo-kecha o'la ha-shofet u'meid d'ish hu v'yartar am Yisrael. The person who willfully acts against the Kohen that is standing there to serve Hashem your God, or against the judge, that person shall die, and you shall eradicate the evil from Israel. So we have here something that's actually very startling. To begin with, first of all, we had this notion. And I saw someone in the post something in the chat. I will, if you do have a question, I would appreciate it if you would unmute yourself and verbalize it, or you can use that the option of raising your hand that you have at your disposal in Zoom. I will try at the end to look at all the questions in the chat. We have on the one hand in the Torah this notion that we are obliged or encouraged to ask questions that we don't know the answers to the Kohanim. Okay, thank you. I'll get to Miriam in a second. To the Kohanim, the Levim, and the Shoftim, to the judges of our time. We're meant to ask them questions, and we are told we have to also follow the directions. Meaning, if once you ask the question and they give you an answer, it's binding. And not just that it's binding. The Torah says, and there's a whole Masechet in Talmud describing this circumstance called Masechet Horiot, which is which says that if you disobey the instructions of the rabbinic authorities near the temple, you are liable for the death penalty. Now, there are specific circumstances in which that's the case, but in some circumstances, if you go and say, although I asked the great court in Jerusalem a question about Jewish law and they gave the following ruling, I think they were wrong. Even if that ruling wasn't the most consequential, it could be something as simple as, I think this food is kosher, they think it's not kosher. Now, eating not kosher, certainly eating kosher, is not punishable by death. But if you go and say the rabbinical court was wrong, then that is punishable by death. So we do have this notion in the Torah itself of rabbinic authority. Okay, so I want to get to Miriam's question now. I'll stop the share for a second, go back to it. Yes, Miriam.
So at the beginning of the pasuk, it says ki palemi imcha. To me, it's saying take a first crack at it yourself. Like it doesn't say that start off saying I need to go to the rabbinical authority. It says, you know, you have the tools, start yourself, but if it eludes you, then go to the rabbinical. Am I misreading it?
No, I don't think so at all. I think that's totally fair. I don't think what that means is, like, you don't have to ask your local Orthodox rabbi every time you want to eat something, and you need to know, you know, what bracha you should make. If you know the bracha, you can make it, right? I think, and the Torah is assuming that we have some level of capability to learn Torah ourselves and get the answers, and it's when you don't. So I think that's totally on. Thank you for that question, though. And again, I always appreciate participation. Let's go back to sharing the screen. So, we do see here this notion of rabbinic authority. Now, there is a limiting factor here, and that is that the Torah is very clear that this rabbinic authority is vested in the rabbis who are near the temple, who are in the place where God shows. And if you look at source number 2, the Rambam talks at length about the rabbinic authority, but it's the rabbinic authority of the great rabbinical court in Yerushalayim. Says the Rambam here in source number 2, Beitin HaGadol sheb'Yerushalayim him ikar Torah sheba'al peh, v'hem amudei ha'ara, v'hem chokum mishpa yotze l'chol Yisrael. So the supreme Sanhedrin Jerusalem are the essence of Torah law, oral law rather, the arbiters of oral law, meaning that although the Torah writes certain things explicitly, there are many implicit things or non-explicit things in the Torah that require interpretation. For instance, things like, what are the 39 things we can't do on Shabbat? What constitutes milacha? What is considered a kosher animal, what is not considered a kosher animal. Things like that, where although there certainly is material on that in the Torah, there are going to be places where there's ambiguity. And the Beit Din HaGadol is charged with dealing with those questions. Va'alehen eticha Torah shenemar al pi ha-Torah shi'arucha. The Torah relied on them when it said that you shall follow the Torah that they instruct you. Zu mitzvah say, this is a positive commandment. V'chol ha-ma'amin b'moshe Rabbeinu v'torato, chayav l'smok ma'aseh hadat aleihen. V'lisha'en aleihen, V'kol mi she'eino oseh keratan over belo taseh shenemar lo tasor min ha'davar asher yagid lachem min usma. Says the Rambam that every single Jew who believes in the Torah is required to rely on this rabbinical court in Yerushalayim, and that anyone who does not do so is violating a positive commandment and a negative commandment. And if you look at the Rambam, he actually goes on to enumerate three different categories where we're obligated to listen to the rabbis. To go back on my American constitutional upbringing, there's both a legislative branch and a judicial branch, in that the rabbis are both given the authority to interpret Torah law, to interpret what a pasuk means, whether either by through tradition or through the exegetical tools that we were given. And they're also given the opportunity and the ability to legislate new laws, things like zerot, decrees, which are there to prevent us from actually violating Torah law, things like new mitzvot, like, for instance, lighting Hanukkah candles. But rabbis are given both. I should know that there is a bit of a controversy as to whether the second category is biblically mandated, whether the Torah itself gives rabbis the ability to make their own laws, and whether that's including Lotasor, but that's what the Rambam says here. That being said, at this point, we don't have a real source for rabbinic authority nowadays. Because nowadays, we do not have a great rabbinical court in Yerushalayim. And this is an important question. When thinking about, well, what's the authority of a rabbinical body in today's day and age, during COVID-19 that issues a pronouncement, we need to derive the source for that rabbinic authority. So the beginning of the answer to this comes from source 3, and the Ron elaborates it on and on source 4. There is another dictum, aside from this idea of lo tasor, that you should not deviate from the rabbinical leaders of Sanhedrin. There is another rule that we follow the majority. That if there is a dispute amongst the sages, we should follow the majority opinion. This is what the Rambam says in source number 3. He says this both generally in terms of how to interpret the Torah and specifically in any given case. So, i.e., if you have two parties who are fighting with each other, one says that the other one owes them money, you go to the court, there are judges at the court, the opinion that is operative is the majority opinion amongst the judges. And the Ron in source number 4 ends up telling us that this idea of following the majority is what buttresses rabbinic law nowadays. That while we no longer have a Sanhedrin in Yerushalayim near the temple, this idea of following the majority opinion of sages even applies today. Take a look what it says in source number 4. I tried to break it up. It's a very important Ron. This is, again, Rabbi Nissen ben Reuven Gerona, otherwise known as the Ron, very important Rishon, commentator on Gemara and halakhic authority in his time. And he asks as follows, V'yish b'kan shela, shelefi divrei ha'parsha zo, ha'achra lo nimsa rak l'sahedre gedola. There's a great question, because according to this section, the ability to make decisions was only given to the Sanhedrin. V'gam sheyihiyu b'mikomam, they even need to be in their place. If that is indeed true, who says, how do we know that we need to follow rabbinical advice nowadays? We no longer have that Sanhedrin. And he says as follows, the answer to this question is that we have this obligation based on the verse which says, follow the majority. That is a general instruction, directive, to follow the laws of the Torah, based on the majority opinion of the sages. He says, we have to follow what they explicitly brought out from the Pesukim, and also generally their interpretation of Torah law. V'zu azharak holele enot liya bizman v'lo b'makom. This is a general directive, which is not contingent upon any time or any place. Vizu inyan haskamah ha-gemara, says the Ran, and it asks a fascinating question. We know that generally we follow the halachic conclusions in the Gemara and the Mishnah. And one question that you could ask is, well, look, the Gemara had big rabbis, but maybe we had big rabbis too. Who says that if we think that there's an opinion in the Gemara which seems far-fetched or off-base, that we can't disagree with an opinion found in the Gemara itself? And the Ran says it's also based on this idea of acharei rabim lehatos. This is the idea of the acceptance of the Talmud and the reason why a Jew cannot argue on its words at all. It is a positive commandment from the Torah to follow the Talmud. Says the Ran, at the time when the Gemara was written and edited and composed, all of the great sages of Israel were present and found in their yeshiva. You had a consensus of rabbinical opinions. And since you had that consensus, when they all got together and completed the Gemara, that Gemara and all its halachic conclusions came with the acceptance of all the great sages of the time. And the ruling of all the sages, of the majority of sages, of any rabbinical sages in any era, is binding. And we know from other sources, you can only overrule that ruling if you have another consensus which is both greater in number and wisdom. So the Ran tells us here, now we have a source for the idea that rabbinical advice and law is still binding. Why? Because of the majority opinion. Now, at this point, you could suggest that we are sort of in a bit of a difficult situation. Because if we really take this to its conclusion, which means we really think that we have to follow the majority opinion in at all times, what that should mean is that even now we should have to follow the majority opinion. And if that is so, then maybe you really should, in any situation, pull a consensus of rabbinic leaders and follow what they say. And, you know, that would sort of prevent a rabbi of a particular shul from really getting their say, because, again, it should really be based on the majority opinion. However, there is a bit of a twist to this as well. The Ran ends up asking from a Gemara in Source 5, we'll read it outside because this is all sort of introductory, where the Gemara says something very striking. It ends up saying that all rabbinic laws, are all backed up by the verse. Apparently my connection is unstable. I hope that's resolved soon. Let me know if you lose me. All rabbinic laws are all based on this dictum of lo tasur, of do not deviate. And that's always the truth. You can look at the source inside yourself. So the Ran is bothered with this Gemara. The Ran just said that lo tasur only applies to the great rabbinical court in Jerusalem when the temple stood, which we no longer have. He then says that, therefore, our requirement to follow rabbinical advice nowadays is based on acharei rabim lahatos, following the majority opinion of the sages in any given era. So then why is it then that the Gemara is saying that lo tasur applies to all rabbinic law? And he gives the following answer. He says the answer is there are two reasons we're obligated to listen to the Sanhedrin. The first is that we have to listen to their explanations of Torah law. And the second is we have to listen to all the new laws that they institute. V'zeo nechlal ba'omro acharei rabim la'tor ach ba'agdarim v'atkanot she'yasu lo nitztaveyu mehem acharei rabim la'tos. He says the difference between Sanhedrin and the generations of rabbinical scholars is that while rabbinic scholars had the ability and are biblically mandated to decide on Torah law, to interpret the laws that already exist, they don't have the same authority to make new laws. Right? Which means that if the rabbis of today's day and age decided together to celebrate Yom Ha'atzma'ut and declare that a holiday, beautiful as it is, it doesn't have the same force as a holiday like Hanukkah or Purim. Even if it was every rabbi in the world. And that is because there's a difference between the original Sanhedrin and rabbinical courts nowadays. However, says the Ran, even though that's true, we still can discern a divine will. And the divine will, what Hashem wants us to do, is still, although it's not explicitly biblically based, is still to follow the advice of the rabbinic sages in every generation. And that's what he concludes with here. Aval hismicho ma'alot asur, shekemo shenatan nazoah ha'koach letzadhejim liyote mori ha'tarag doleha, just as the Torah gave the great rabbinical court in Jerusalem the ability to make new laws, king ra'oi sheyinatein l'chol chachmei gedolei Yisrael b'derech ha'asmachta. It's also worthy to give this power, legislative power, to all Jewish sages, at least based on this paradigm. So the upshot of what we've seen until now, and this is in terms of rabbinic authority, is as follows. I think it's important to sort of consider. There are two sources, potentially, for rabbinic authority nowadays, for why it is we listen to rabbinic decisions from today's day and age. One source is this idea of following the majority opinion, and that applies to the majority opinion in terms of how to interpret Torah law. Interpreting the law that already exists, okay? Then there's another idea. This idea is much more difficult to define. It's much more difficult to formulate. But it is the idea of Ratzon HaTorah. Rav Hanan Wasserman, in one of his pieces on rabbinic law, talks about this. And that is the idea that although the rabbis of today's day and age do not have the same legislative power to make new decisions, but based on Torah law, we can infer that there is an ideal of following the advice of our sages. Essentially, every generation has its own unique set of problems and circumstances, and every generation is going to need rabbis who have the authority to address those problems and circumstances. And so, although it might not be biblically mandated to follow those new, rulings and proclamations, it's still based on a Torah ideal. And so I think those are two things that are important to think about in framing the issues of today regarding COVID-19. When the rabbis are issuing these new declarations and proclamations, are they interpreting Torah law? In which case, it really is worth considering majority opinion, although we'll adjust that in a bit. Or are they sort of enacting something new? And if they are enacting something new, then on the one hand, it doesn't necessarily have that same Torah stamp on it. You can't necessarily quote a verse in the Torah which says you must listen to the rabbis when they tell you to do something. But I think it's also a bit more amorphous and flexible. Because if the idea is listening to the Ratzon HaTorah, to what Hashem would want us to do, based on the advice of our rabbis, it might be dependent upon a particular situation. Not all situations are necessarily the same. So that's in terms of general introduction to rabbinic law as it was and in today's day and age. Any questions before we move on? Okay. Yes.
I'm curious to know how the whole concept of Das Torah falls into this, considering that you're talking about majority and Das Torah always seems to be one person's opinion, whereby everybody is assumed that they should be following it?
That is an excellent question. I am hoping, so we'll definitely address that to some degree. To address it briefly now. So I think it depends what you mean by Das Torah. Das Torah sometimes means an opinion on a halachic issue. It sometimes means an opinion on a non-halachic issue. And the next thing we're going to discuss is actually, what about rabbinic opinions on issues that don't necessarily reflect any Torah law that have to do with communal policy? So that's one issue to think about. In terms of, and we'll get to, in terms of the other, let me take a break from the screen sharing because it sort of tires me out for a second. In terms of your other question, another thing to think about is the status of a gadol, a great Torah scholar. Now, defining a gadol, as we'll see, is not so simple, but there is a certain status and stature that a great Torah scholar has, such that it's less, that he might even be able to impose that opinion, even, I won't say against the majority, but it will be discouraged to argue with that opinion. It will be a greater hurdle to leap than just simply arguing with any other rabbi. And the third thing we'll talk about is a rabbi in a specific locale. But yes, there is another question. Yes, Mark. If there's a two groups in a locale, you're saying. Is that is your question, if there are two rabbinical groups in one place, who should we follow? Right.
One group is saying it's definitely okay, and another is saying absolutely not, close to trade.
So I would say, that's a good question. You know what? Based on what we've seen until now, that seems to be an interpretation of the law in the Talmud. If we had the same framework that we've been discussing until now, you would think that it would be the type of thing that should be decided. Based on majority opinion, but we'll see. It's not necessarily so simple. That's what we'll see in a few minutes. Okay, so let's go back to the source sheet and let's move on let's move on to the next part of this question. So the next thing to consider, though, is the following, and I think this is not, again, an easy question to answer, and that is, what is the nature of the pronouncements and recommendations that have been issued recently? Would you call them Torah law? Would you call them sort of recommendation? Would you call them communal policy? I don't know if it's so easy to answer. On the one hand, you could argue that it is, in a sense, Torah law because, you know, the Torah is concerned with saving lives. The Torah is concerned with pikuach nefesh. Minyan is a mitzvah, which is included in Torah law. Praying is a commandment, a part of religious life. At the same time, I feel like there's a certain sense that what the rabbis are really doing now is trying to dictate what their communities should do on a more global level. Saying things like wear masks, or saying things like, you know, you have to appoint someone in each minyan to make sure that people are social distancing. To me, it's a different feel to it than saying something like, let's say, you know, it's permitted to drink milk that's not Chalav Yisrael because we are confident that the government can ensure its kosher status. It's a different feel to it. So the next thing I'd like to sort of explore briefly is this notion of communal policy and how is communal policy established. So on the one, so here we actually have a bit of a dispute. It's not 100% clear. One question is, do we follow the majority in terms of communal policy? If there is a policy in the community in terms of things like paying taxes, contributing to communal funds, can the majority impose that institution on the other members of the community? So it's not so simple. You look at source number 7, there are Shlomo ben Adera, the Rashba, great rabbinic sage in Barcelona, also a very well-known commentator on the Gemara, says that you actually, you need a consensus. You don't just need a majority in terms of communal policy. It says here, well, I'll just read it in English, know that in any case in which the congregation accepted the opinions of four or five people, meaning if you have a community which appoints the heads of the community to make decisions for them, four or five of them, for instance, or more, we don't follow the majority. For we only follow the majority in court. If they don't all agree to one opinion, the defendant is exempt, for we maintain the status quo of a person and his finances until he knows he is liable. And the fact that Shulchan Aruch quotes this Rashba, what the Rashba is saying is, in terms of communal policy requiring someone to give a certain amount of money or a donation, we don't follow the majority. You need a broad consensus, even from a communal board. It's not enough to say that most people in the communal board agree to the pronouncement. You need a consensus. However, if you look at the Rush in source number 8, he actually disagrees. It sounds like the Rush, Rush Ben Yechiel, who was, I'll note the Rashba happens to be a Sephardic posek. The Rosh was, although he lived in Toledo later in his life, he is generally associated with the Ashkenazi school of thought. So the Rosh says as follows. Can two or three people get themselves out of a communal agreement? Right? So if you have a community that agrees to do something, they agree that you have to contribute to a certain fund. They agree that you have to abide by a certain edict. You have two or three people who are not so enthralled with this edict. We'll say for argument's sake, if the communal edict is everybody has to wear a mask outside in the advent of COVID-19 and we have a psak, that's what you need to do, and everybody agrees, we have a communal board meeting. And then you have one, two or three people that say no. You don't have that. So I don't want to listen. I don't want to wear a mask. The Rush says you have to follow the majority. He says, "Da ki al esek shel rabim amra Torah achare rabim latos." Val kol inyan shel kal maskimim holchem achar harov. Vayechidin tzrichim the kaim kol ma sheyaskimu aleihem harabim. Regarding all communal matters, we follow the majority, and the individuals need to fulfill whatever the majority agrees to. Dim lo kin lo olam lo yaskimu hakol hashom davar im yeko apiyachin levatel haskamatan. If we don't follow the majority, we'll never get anything done. You're never going to get a consensus opinion. So we're never going to accomplish anything as a community unless we follow the majority. Therefore, the Torah says regarding all communal matters, follow the majority. So again, I think one issue in this regard, should we be subject, for instance, to the majority opinion in regard to things like COVID-19 pronouncements and the like? I think part of it does depend on this question. Does the realm of the majority opinion, does that solely focus on Torah law or court, or does it even extend to more communal pronouncements? And that's another question to consider. I don't know that it's a dispute in the authorities. In the Shulchan Aruch, it sounds like we actually paskin that no, you need a consensus. And in that vein, maybe we wouldn't be bound to the majority opinion. And a rabbi would have the ability to make their own decision. Another factor, though, to consider is, even if we'll agree that you can follow the majority of who? Who is the majority we're following? Now, in the time of the Talmud, there were rabbis of cities, as we'll get to. There are also appointed courts. Do we necessarily have the same appointments, the same official positions, the same people speaking for the community that we had in those days? Every shuls have boards, but I don't know that the same applies necessarily to a community in general. Would the Vad HaRabbanim be the appointed committee which the community has vested with the power to make decisions for the community? I'm not 100% sure about that. If you look in source number 9, on the one hand, the Talmud says here, Rishain b'neha ir lahat nora al midov al sharim v'aschar polim lasiya al kitzatan. The people in a city have the right to stipulate regarding measurements, prices, wages, and to fine for those who violate those stipulations. However, many authorities comment, and this is one. This is the Maharik, Rabbi Joseph Ben Salman Cologne, in his response, says this only applies when the entirety of the community appointed these officials. Either you need everybody literally in the community to make this announcement that this is what we're going to do, this is going to be the price, or whatever the policy is, or you need appointed officials via everybody. So even if you would say we follow the majority, do we necessarily have a body which has been appointed by the community to whose opinion we are bound to? Now, I'm not 100% sure about this one. I think, and I'd love to maybe after hear some opinions on this. I think that on the one end, in Toronto specifically, there is sort of the COR, and you could say the Vad HaRabbanim, sort of do run a lot of communal issues. They, you know, there's the kashrut. You know, we rely on rabbinic authorities or rabbinical bodies for mikveh usage, for kashrut, for many things of that nature. If we're relying on them, maybe you could argue that they have some status as an appointed body. However, I'm not 100% sure about that. There still never was any broad consensus of Jews who said we are now agreeing that the rabbinic authority of the Vad HaRabbanim of Toronto gets to make decisions for the entire community. Again, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't listen to them and we shouldn't take their word seriously, but I don't know if they had the same authority as a general majority opinion in this regard. So that leaves us with probably the final issue to discuss. I know we're running out of time, so I'll try to move through it a bit quickly. And that is the power of Mara D'Asra. Right? The title of the shir actually is a city with many Mara D'Asra. And when we generally think of Mara D'Asra, we think of a shul rabbi. We'll say Rabbi Karapkin is the Mara D'Asra of the Bayit. However, the words Mara D'Asra actually mean the master of the place. And in the times of the Gemara, you had a rabbi who was considered the primary authority of the entire locale, the entire city. All the rabbis knew that in that place, there was one rabbi who called the shots, whose opinion they all respected because of their stature. You find this in a very striking way in the Gemara in Shabbat. I'll briefly summarize it for you outside. We have the opinion of Rebbe Eliezer. Rebbe Eliezer held the specific application is that you can, in order to perform a circumcision on Shabbat, not only can you violate Shabbat to perform the actual circumcision, you can even violate Shabbat to prepare and enable preparatory stages for precision. So you can sharpen the knife and violate Shabbat. You can carry a knife to the place where the milah needs to be done. That's also okay. Now, we don't passing like Rebbe Eliezer. And the Gemara says, according to Rebbe Eliezer, you can even cut down trees in order to use those trees to make charcoal, in order to use the charcoal to make the knife, in order to do the circumcision. Now, we don't pask in that way, because that's very preparatory. It's not the actual milah. However, the Gemara says, in a very striking way, and I'll just skip to this part of it, that although that's true, it says as follows. There was one city in Israel that followed this opinion. They died at their appropriate time, and they lived long lives. Not only that, there is one time in which the Roman government made a decree that you can't do a circumcision, and that place, which followed Rabbi Eliezer's opinion, was spared from that decree. And sort of what the Mefarshim say here on a spiritual level, in a very profound way, what the Gemara is saying is the rabbi of a locale has authority in that locale. The people who live there have the right to follow the opinion of the Mara de Asra, of their rabbi, even if it's against the majority opinion, even if globally it's not the accepted halachic opinion. We don't passen like Rabbi Eliezer in terms of Mila, and yet they were saved from this decree because they followed their rabbi. You see this in many sources. You can take a look here in the Ron, another response on source number 12, where he says the people in a place are obligated to follow the words of their great sages, even when many argue against them. And he quotes this Gemara in Shabbos, again, noting that we follow the majority opinion, the opinion of the Mara de Asra. Who is the Mara de Asra in today's day and age? This is, again, the crucial question. I think that it's not 100% clear. Can you view the main rabbinical body of a community as together a Mara de Asra? It's an interesting thought. Should you say that the Mara de Asra of every shul is the rabbinic authority for their shul? Now, to that point, although in some sense it makes sense to suggest that, the Chevel Nachalator, Yaakov Epstein, in Source 13, talks at length about how the nature of halacha has changed drastically from the times of the Talmud, and that it's really hard to apply the legal term Mara de Asra to today's rabbis. He notes three different factors which are different today. Number one, he says, most halachic decisions are already written in books. When rabbis make decisions nowadays, it's not their novel shita, their novel opinion that they came up with that we're following. What they're doing is deciding between different opinions which have already been written down in many sfarim for generations. And it's not just that they're deciding that, they have to. No rabbi can say nowadays, this is what I think the Gemara means, and disregard the Shulchan Aruch and the Rishonim and the Achronim. We're beholden to those texts. So the nature of the decision is different. And number two and three, there's a certain diversity of the community such that there's no place where everybody here grew up together. We've been here for generations. Maybe Toronto actually is a bit different, but people come through Ashkenazim, there are Sephardim, there are Lithuanians, there are people that come from Galicia. They all have their customs. A rabbi can't tell someone who comes from a different background, follow my background, right? No, an Ashkenazic rabbi cannot tell a Sephardic Jew that they have to follow Ashkenazic customs. That's not in their authority. They don't have that same purview that a Mara de Asra used to have. And finally, the third factor is this idea that even in any given place, people don't stay there forever. They go from place to place. You'll be in Toronto in one period, and you could go to Hamilton in another period, and maybe you'll end up in New York eventually. And so who's your Mara de Asra? It used to be, you stayed in a pretty much one community, and you had a Mara de Asra. Now it's not so simple. For many, these and many other reasons, what he argues is that we no longer have this notion of Mara de Asra in the way we used to. Now what does that mean? So I like to I think I'm even a bit over. So I'm going to sum up a bit, to make succinctly. On the one hand, I think that we don't have the same rabbinic authority in terms of these pronouncements. We don't have the traditional majority that we used to have. It's not the same rabbim. We don't have the same appointees we used to have. In terms of really applying the legal mechanisms we have to adjudicate halach decisions, we're lacking those and it's hard to really sincerely apply them to rabbinic pronouncements. You could even argue, even in terms of a shul rabbi, if you ask your shul rabbi a question, you should certainly follow it. But are you obligated to ask the rabbi of your shul all of your questions? If you had another rabbi in another community where you spent the majority of your life, and now you went to a new city, do you have to ask the rabbi that all your questions? I'm not sure. The Hevel Nachlaso thinks you don't. I don't think it's obvious that you do. Furthermore, even in terms of what I'll say, just to allude to another point, the great Torah scholars of today, the big names that everybody knows about, I'll just say Rav Shlomo Miller in Toronto, a world-renowned Torah scholar. Everybody knows Rav Shlomo Miller. Hevel Nachlaso argues, and Rav Moshe Feinstein here argues, that although there is basis for not arguing on a greater rabbi, we don't really apply that in the same way nowadays. Or Moshe, it's actually, you can look at it inside. Moshe says, someone asks him a question and apologize for disagreeing with him. And he says, you don't need to apologize for disagreeing with me. Even if you think that I'm a gadol, right? Because who would think Moshe Feinstein's a gadol? Of course we would, but he doesn't think that. But even if you think I'm a gadol, you can still disagree. And you have to disagree. And if you disagree with me, you have to say so. I think you're wrong, but disagree with me. So in terms of, this notion of being bound to specific rabbinic authority, I don't know that that exists. However, I think that there is a certain agreement that when you're the member of a shul, that you are at least signing on to respect the opinion of the rabbi in your shul. And I think that that acceptance part of it is important. I think you could argue that the congregants in a shul and the members of a community do see their rabbi as their posek, at least in terms of the questions that they ask him. And there is a certain authority that the rabbi of a shul has, which, although maybe not a full-fledged Mar D'Asra, can be compared to them in the sense that the community accepts them as their, or the shul, the synagogue accepts him as a posek. And the Ratzon HaTorah element, the idea that there's this notion that the Torah wants us to follow the sages in our day, I think can also be applied. That, you know, it will behoove every shul and community to follow their rabbinic leaders so that society can function. Just to close, there is a certain difficulty with these questions because it's not easy when people argue. And when you have a lot of different opinions in one community, in one city, it's hard to play that balancing act of, on the one end, following your rabbi, but respecting all opinions. But the truth is that we're no strangers to disagreement in Judaism, and that wisdom often is subject to disagreement. And Rav Cook here very poignantly notes, has the following comments on disagreement. We read at the end of Musaf on Shabbat, Talmidei Chachamim Marbim Shalom Ba'olam, Torah sages increase peace in the world. And the question is, no, they don't. Torah scholars are arguing all the time. The 10 scholars, 11 opinions. What do you mean increase peace in the world? Rav Cook says as follows, Yesh Toim Shechoshem Sha Shalom Alami Lo Yivneh Kima Dei Tzivyon Echad. There are those who mistakenly think that world peace can only be built if everybody thinks the same thing. In King Kisharon, Tamnei Chachamim, Kolkrim B'chachma, Adei HaMechkar, Mitrabim HaTzadim VaShitot, Choshen Shebezehim, Garim Lachlok HaHefech HaShalom. If so, they think when people are learning together and investigating and researching and they come up with a million different options and opinions, so that's the opposite of peace. But that ain't okay, it's the opposite. It's not true. The only way that there can be peace is if it's shalom rab, marbim shalom, a multiplicity of peace. Haribe shel shalom hu shidru kol hatzadim v'kol hashitot sheyesh b'chachma. The multiplicity of peace means that you see all the different sides and perspectives on the issue, all the different opinions in wisdom. And you can see how each one has its place. Each thing according to its value, time, and its nature. So I think that although it's not 100% clear which Mar D'Asra we should be following, there is a certain beauty in respecting all the different elements of Torah and all the different priorities and thoughts that emanate from the multiplicity of viewpoint within our rabbinic leaders. And I hope, and let's hope, that through this crisis, we can at least appreciate that issues are difficult And there's a beauty in having a conglomerate of rabbinic authorities we can turn to who will each present their unique opinion. Okay, so I'm going to hold here. I'll stay on for the questions hosted in the chat. I was asked, I think, to post the...